Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grian and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a dramatic appeal to world leaders at the United Nations Climate Conference in Poland. He called climate change the most important issue we face.
I want to deliver four simple messages. First, science demands a significantly more ambitious response. Second, the Paris Agreement provides the framework for action, so we must operationalize it. Third, we have a collective responsibility to invest in averting global climate chaos, to consolidate the financial commitments made in Paris, and to assist the most vulnerable communities and nations. And fourth, climate action offers a compelling path to transform our world for the better.
Famed British naturalist Sir David Attenborough echoed his warning.
At this crucial moment, the United Nations has invited the world's people to have their voice heard by giving them a seat, the people's seat. The people's seat gives an opportunity for everyone to join us here today, virtually, and speak directly to you, the decision makers. In the last 2 weeks, the world's people have taken part in building this address, answering polls, sending video messages, and voicing their opinions. I am only here to represent the voice of the people, to deliver our collective thoughts, concerns, ideas, and suggestions. This is our We the People's message.
I'd like to thank the UN for inviting me to share my thoughts.
We're facing this global challenge of climate change.
We're increasingly witnessing impacts of climate change in China with our own eyes.
That is already affecting us in a really scary way.
Things are affecting our vida.
Climate change affects everyone.
And will continue to affect millions of the world's poorest people.
The people's seat, giving millions the opportunity to talk directly to you, the leaders and decision makers today.
The world's people have spoken. Their message is clear. Time is running out. Leaders of the world, you must lead. The continuation of our civilizations and the natural world upon which we depend is in your hands. Thank you.
Guterres chided countries, especially those most responsible for greenhouse gas emissions, for failing to do enough to back the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The accord set a goal of keeping global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. And in Mexico, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO, was sworn in this Saturday after winning the Mexican elections in July by 53%. Tens of thousands of people gathered in the Zocalo to celebrate the victory of the leftist president. AMLO ran on an anti-corruption campaign and has pledged to fight against violence and poverty. We'll talk more about AMLO's victory and what it means for Mexico in part two of our show. In other news, Wisconsin Republicans moved to change the 2020 presidential primary date and make sweeping changes to the duties of the governor and attorney general. The changes being sought would shift power to the GOP-controlled legislator and allow outgoing Republican Governor Scott Walker to make one last major mark on the state's political landscape after losing re-election last month. Democratic Governor-elect Tony Evers said the lame duck session, the first in Wisconsin in 8 years, is an attempt to invalidate the results of the November election, where Democrats won every constitutional office. I think it's the wrong message, I think it's an embarrassment for the state, and I think we can stop it, Evers said. And in California, thousands of children returned to school today, 3 weeks after the deadly campfire destroyed their homes and classrooms. Schools in Butte County have been closed since November 8th when the blaze swept through the towns of Paradise, Concho, and Megalia. Counselors brought in from around the country were in nearly every classroom to help children who are distressed by the loss of their homes and memories of escaping the fire. It was California's deadliest wildfire in a century. At least 88 people were killed and dozens still remain unaccounted for. Higher temperatures and drier vegetation caused by climate change has created bigger fires in California. 15 of the 20 largest fires in the state's history have occurred since the year 2000.
In local news, dozens from Sunrise, New York, and Indivisible Brooklyn rallied outside of Senator Chuck Schumer's New York City office this afternoon. The activists demanded that the senator push forward a plan to address climate change by urging the ranking member of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee to support the Green New Deal. Sunrise, a grassroots movement fighting climate change, supports Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's resolution for a select committee that would develop a plan for the U.S. to become carbon neutral by the year 2020. Activists from Critical Resistance and No New Jails organized a community speak out on Sunday to talk about Mayor Bill de Blasio's plan to replace Rikers Island with borough-based jails. Those at the speak out, many of whom are part of the prison abolitionist movement, reject de Blasio's plan to construct the new jails. They say it perpetuates the criminal justice system's flaws and wastes funds that could be used to invest in community resources instead. The city says it will construct the four jails in every borough except Staten Island by the year 2027. The city canceled plans last Wednesday to build a new jail in Chinatown and will instead expand the existing Manhattan detention complex known as the Toms. Today we have John Tarleton, the editor of The Independent, who will be guest hosting our segment on the latest developments in the ongoing MTA saga. Welcome, John.
Hi, Elliot. It's great to be here today with you and all the WBI listeners. So earlier today, New York City subway commuters experienced another morning from hell. Signal problems at Bergen Street in Brooklyn and 57th Street in Manhattan caused heavy delays on the F and G lines that rippled through the system. One exhausted F train commuter tweeted, quote, "We got people in outer space today and you can't get me to a different borough." Well, relief of a sort is on the way. The Federal Transit Administration recently gave the green light in its environmental review of the second phase of the Second Avenue subway project. The first phase was completed in 2017 and added three subway stations to the Q line between 63rd and 96th Street. It took a decade to complete and cost more than $4 billion. Phase two would extend the Q line three more stops from 96th Street to 125th Street, where it would meet with the 4, 5, and 6 trains at Lexington Avenue. It's projected to take at least a decade to complete and cost upwards of $6 billion. Is this the best use of our mass transit resources? We're joined today by New York City transportation reporter Aaron Gordon. Aaron is the author of the weekly Signal Problems newsletter. It covers all things related to New York subways and is quite informative. Aaron, welcome to Indy Radio News.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's great to have you with us. So first of all, what do you see as the pros and cons of phase two of the Second Avenue subway project getting this green light from the feds? And is this what we need at this time when our subway system has so many other problems to be addressed?
Well, I think it's a complicated answer to that. There's no clear answer. I think if you talk to the residents of East Harlem or the people who would benefit directly from this line by having a subway station much closer to where they live, they would say that yes, it is good, because even with all the struggles the system is having, because this has been planned for much longer than that, and there's no reason not to do both. But I think if you talk to most people who ride the system every day, they would say that there are other more urgent needs, and that maybe this isn't the best use of the agency's money at this time. But to get into that conversation, you really have to start talking about where the money comes from, right? Which is And the capital plan, which is separate from the operating costs to run the system day to day, comes from an agreement between the state and the city on how much they're going to give to the MTA every 5 years to build these big new projects. And so then you get into a conversation about how fungible the money is between the capital plan and the operating costs, and whether, you know, you can really transfer between two. So it's a complicated discussion with no real clear takeaway.
Mm. But why are MTA construction projects in New York so expensive? Mile for mile, they're the most expensive new subway tracks in human history by a long margin, compared even to established cities like New York and, I mean, like London and Paris.
Absolutely, they are. And it's one of the main arguments against continuing with phase two, I think, until we have a much better idea of how to get those costs under control. Interestingly, though, the problem with cost overruns on mega projects, of course, it's very complicated, right? But one of the things that the MTA actually does pretty well, at least by international standards, is dig tunnels. It's actually not that expensive compared to other cities for the MTA to actually dig the tunnel. What is way more expensive in New York than anywhere else is building the stations and all the accompanying infrastructure with that. So the Second Avenue subway, the three new stations, were by far the cost drivers for why those were the most expensive tracks per mile on Earth. And the new Second Avenue line is, at least at this current juncture, is projected to continue that trend, because they're really over designing the stations themselves, especially with the big new hub at 125th Street to connect with the 456 line. It'll be a very large station, and that will continue the cost overrun problem. So until they figure out how to really build stations more reasonably, and that's not purely an MTA problem, there are actually regulations about designing these stations for passenger flow that honestly are too demanding, that require too much space. I mean, like, if you just go to the Second Avenue stations, you can see how much space there is, like, compared to other subway stations. And that really makes things way more expensive than they necessarily have to be. But there are legal requirements there that have to be changed.
Right. And is the problem purely technical problems, or is there... Are these essentially, in some ways, pork projects? I mean, pork gets laid on. And I wanted to ask if you could talk about the nexus between, say, Governor Cuomo, the MTA, big real estate, big construction, and why spending billions to add these three stations to one subway line is so much more alluring than maintaining and fixing the system as a whole, which Cuomo in particular has shown very little interest in.
Right. So I think from Governor Cuomo's perspective, building new things is always more attractive to politicians than maintaining old things. That is not unique to Cuomo. It's not unique to New York. It's pretty much a universal rule. Politicians like ribbon cuttings. They like to say they built new things. And particularly with the Second Avenue subway, Governor Cuomo took a special interest in that project and finishing it, precisely because it had languished so long in the MTA bureaucracy, and he wanted to be known as the governor who got that project across the finish line, who finished it. And he did, and he's campaigned on that, and he's made it, you know, a focus of his administration, and he wants to do more of that. You know, he wants to be known as the guy who saw East Side Access to its completion. He wanted to be the guy who got phase two started, you know, all of these things. I don't think he anticipated, nor did really anybody anticipate, just how teetering on the precipice of disaster the subway was on a day-to-day basis. And now that's something he has to deal with unexpectedly. And it's also a more difficult problem to solve, because it's much harder to communicate to voters what you did and how you did it to fix it that doesn't implicitly admit the shortcomings of his administration beforehand, because, of course, he was overseeing the system when it fell apart, right? So he's kind of in a bind in terms of his political interest there. In terms of, like, the nexus with real estate and whether these are pork projects or not, I don't have any, like, direct evidence that there are people, you know, like, in a room figuring out how to make these projects as expensive as possible. I even know that some real estate people are interested in seeing the projects cut in cost, because if they remain so expensive, they can't build more of them, and that limits the opportunity for these real estate executives to increase the value of the properties they hold, right? The more the subway can build into more areas, the more property is going to rise in value. So I think there is some interest from the real estate to actually do the opposite, to cut costs. Certainly there are parties, I'm thinking specifically, you know, some public sector unions that I don't think have a particular interest or incentive to reduce the labor costs on these projects, because fewer labor costs means fewer workers working fewer hours, which means fewer union members. The incentives are pretty clear there.
Right. We'll have to leave it there for now, Aaron. And thank you, Aaron Gordon, for joining us tonight, author of the weekly Signal Problems newsletter, which covers all things New York City subway.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. And you're listening to 99.5
WBAI. Thank you, and welcome back to WBAI, to Indy Radio News. On the second half of the show, we're going to talk about Mexico. Saturday marked a historic moment for Mexico, as Manuel López Obrador was sworn into office as its new president. I will govern with rectitude and justice. I will not fail you. I will not disappoint you. I won't betray the people, he said as he addressed the media after his triumph. In his inaugural speech, AMLO, as they know him for his initials, addressed security and vowed to end corruption and impunity. He runs on an anti-corruption campaign and has proposed raising the minimum wage, expanding access to education, ending the drug war, and addressing the root social causes of crime and violence.
Un cambio de régimen político. A partir de ahora se llevará a cabo una transformación pacífica y ordenada, pero al mismo tiempo profunda y radical, porque se acabará con la corrupción y con la impunidad que impiden el renacimiento de México.
As he was saying in his inaugural speech, he talks about a change of governments, a new era for Mexico with different priorities. AMLO, or López Obrador, won in a landslide with 53% in July against his rivals Ricardo Anaya from the National Action Party, which received 22% of the votes, and José Antonio Meade, who was in the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which has ruled Mexico for most of the last century, who came in with a 16%. AMLO's campaign is called Juntos Haremos Historia, or Together We'll Make History, and he has more women in his cabinet than any other in Mexican history. His campaign is a three-party coalition from a left-wing Labor Party, right-wing Social Encounter Party, and Morena, the leftist national regeneration movement that he founded in 2014. To talk more about this new president and the current situation in Mexico, we have Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program in Mexico City. She holds a master's in Latin American Studies from Stat University and is a frequent writer and commenter of U.S.-Mexican relations. She has an article in the current issue of The Independent called Mexico's AMLO Bucks the Trend, but will he buck the system? You can find it on the website, independent.org. Hello, Laura.
Hi, thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for being on. I wanted to start out just so to understand the bigger picture. Why is AMLO's victory so meaningful? And in your opinion, what is it that people are looking forward for him to be, for his first steps to be?
It's particularly meaningful because the left in Mexico has been trying and running candidates to harvest the discontent within the country, which is widespread for many years now, and within a system where fraud and vote buying and manipulation of the vote has really been the norm rather than the exception. So there have actually been two elections just recently that were stolen from center-leftist candidates. In 1988, not that recently, but for some of us who have a long memory, the candidacy of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was basically considered to have been stolen in that election. And then in 2006, the first run for the presidency of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, when authorities gave the election to the conservative Felipe Calderón by half a percentage vote, half a percentage difference, and then refused to do a broad vote recount. So it's been a long, hard road to get to where he's gotten here and where the left in some ways has gotten as well. The other part of it is look at the international context. Right now what we're seeing throughout Latin America and also in other parts of the world, Europe included, there was just a recent election in Spain, is that it's been the extreme right and these almost neo-fascist currents that are really taking advantage of people's widespread desire for change with the current situation in the world today and in their specific countries. So the fact that that López Obrador won in Mexico, the second largest economy in Latin America, at a time when we're seeing these triumphs by Bolsonaro in Brazil and by other right-wing governments, shows that it's a real volatile time and that there is a possibility for a discourse of economic redistribution, of getting rid of a neoliberal economic model to triumph in this context.
And that's sort of building up to the next question, which is that these leftist governments have been highly criticized, especially AMLO. He's been referred to as a very populist politician. And I was wondering, what is your opinion? Because people say that one of the problems is that it's similar to Venezuela's case in Chavez.
Well, I'm a political scientist by training, and I've looked long and hard, and the word populist really has no definition. It has no formal definition in political science that is agreed upon. And what we say, it's always seemed very strange to me as also an individual who's looked a lot at movements for democracy within the world, that populist would become a criticism when populist or being government by the people is actually the definition of democracy. What's happened here is that López Obrador has created a number of mechanisms and also just even the style of his campaign to include people as well as represent excluded and forgotten sectors of the Mexican population in his government. He has a government with the highest, most equal rate of representation of women in both the cabinet and in the Morena, his party, the National Regeneration Movement, presence in Congress among almost all nations of the world. It's pretty close to 50-50 in both the cabinet and in the Congress. He's also created a mechanism that's been criticized and with some grounds, but for consulting on major decisions within the government, criticized because it probably needs to be worked out and people should be informed of all the particulars before entering into a consultation. And he has proposed formally that there be a vote 2.5 years, that is halfway into his administration, to revoke his mandate if that's what the people want to do. So we really have a different style of government, especially compared to Mexico, coming out still of over 70 years of authoritarian one-party rule, and then this alteration that was agreed upon between the conservatives and the former Institutional Revolutionary Party that formerly governed, that's beginning to look like a very different style and substance for government.
And I was going to ask you, what are the challenges that AMLO is going to have to face? He has a very ambitious plan. What is it that he needs to go over to be able to end the drug war and really get education and minimum wage as one of the forefronts of his victories?
Oof, that's a really big question, and it's the one that everybody's asking now. He put forward 100 different measures or commitments, he called them, during his speech to the people in the Mexico City Central Plaza or Zócalo. And among those, they go from the fairly particular, like selling the presidential plane, which was extremely expensive and a sign of the waste and the luxury of past administrations, and that's something that's already happened, to, you know, reducing violence and other very difficult and probably much longer term problems. He really does need to get the homicide rate down and reduce the violence, not just the murders, but the disappearances. There are over 37,000 disappearances within the country in the context of this violence that's attributed to both corrupt state agents and members of organized crime here in Mexico. He'll have to do that by not only purging, corrupt or complicit government agents, but also by changing the model. There's a real consensus, and this was part of the reason behind his victory, that this war on drugs model that was imposed from the United States has not only not worked in Mexico, it's clear that it hasn't worked. The homicide rate has actually gone up consistently since it was applied, and the drug flows have not gone down, but also that it's been counterproductive, that it's actually more of a cause than a solution to the problem. So there's a lot of skepticism, or there's a lot of concern, rather, on the part of especially human rights organizations about whether or what Andrés Manuel López Obrador is going to do about that problem, because he announced the formation of a National Guard, which is run by the armed forces, and one of the major criticisms of the way the war on drugs was carried out in Mexico was that the armed forces were so involved in domestic policing. So there's concern about that. He will also need to create jobs. I was talking to a number of people in the Zócalo on Saturday, December 1st, the day of the inauguration, and it was one of the most frequent topics to come up.
Well, thank you so much, Sara. We're going to have to leave it here because we're running out of time, and look forward to see how AMLO's government develops over the years. Thank you so much for listening to WBAI Radio.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at independent.org, that's Indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to The Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.